This is Nightline.
Tonight, damning report. The year-long investigation rocking the world of women's soccer.
The investigation's findings are heartbreaking, infuriating, and deeply troubling.
The disturbing allegations of systemic abuse suffered by players, plus diversity controversy. Teachers stressed across the country. Classrooms turned into political battlefields.
A lot of teachers feel like they're walking on eggshells.
One Minneapolis policy sparking national debate.
In the event of layoffs, white teachers have to be fired first, regardless of seniority or performance.
Prioritizing teachers from underrepresented groups to correct historical wrongs.
If you go back to Brown versus Board, who were the first teachers to be let go when we, you know, integrated schools? Black teachers.
And NFL fallout. The tough questions facing the league.
Down he goes.
After the hits suffered by Tua Tagovailoa. What former players have to say.
You can get a new arm, you can get a new leg, you only have one brain.
Nightline, we'll be right back.
Good evening, thank you for joining us. U.S. women's soccer plagued for years over issues of pay equity, now confronting the disturbing findings of a year-long investigation. It alleges a culture of systemic misconduct, including sexual, verbal, and emotional abuse suffered by players. Here's ABC's Eva Pilgrim.
Tonight, a damning new report into U.S. women's soccer, an investigation finding abuse and misconduct had become systemic, spanning multiple teams, coaches, and victims.
We felt like we had enough information to be able to demonstrate not only the specific conduct with respect to a number of coaches, but also the systemic failings that allowed it to happen.
The independent probe finding abuse in the National Women's Soccer League was rooted in a deeper culture in women's soccer, beginning in youth leagues, and that the teams, the league, and the U.S. Soccer Federation repeatedly failed to respond appropriately to players' allegations and evidence, allowing abusive coaches to move from team to team. The investigation initiated last year by the Federation after allegations from 2015 into former Portland Thorns manager Paul Riley became public and sparked a reckoning. Players staging a mid-game pause in solidarity. Five teams dropping their coaches amid allegations of misconduct, including Riley. Former Thorns midfielder Mana Shim speaking to ESPN's E60, alleging Riley invited her to his hotel room.
I was terrified. And I knew at that point that I had to find a way out, and I was not willing to compromise myself for my career or for this person.
Our thanks to Eva. ABC News reached out to Paul Riley. We have not heard back. But in 2021, he denied all allegations. U.S. Women's Soccer says they plan to implement immediate actions to protect players, including mandating background checks. And now to the other story that's left the sports world reeling. The NFL facing scrutiny and outrage over tailing of the Miami Dolphins star quarterback. The saga started last Sunday in a game against the Buffalo Bills. Tua Tagovailoa returning to the field after taking a hit that left him stumbling.
Roughing the passer.
Then 4 days later on Thursday against the Cincinnati Bengals.
Down he goes.
Tua getting slammed to the ground, his fingers seizing in a response known as fencing, a sign of neurological trauma.
Serious force, he goes down.
He was placed in concussion protocol and rushed to the hospital. The Dolphins have been adamant they followed proper protocol. The NFL Players Association began an investigation into the timeline of events. Sources telling ESPN that the unaffiliated neurotrauma consultant who examined Tua was fired over the weekend for making, quote, several mistakes in his evaluation. ABC News learning investigators expect to interview Tua early this week as part of their review and say new concussion protocols could be released any day. Joining me now, Matt Hasselbeck, former NFL quarterback and analyst for ESPN's NFL Sunday Countdown, and Emmanuel Acho, former NFL player and best-selling author. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. The two of you are both former NFL players. You've been out there taking hits like that on the field. What did you think when you saw Tua on the ground last Thursday? Matt, start with you.
Well, he never should have been out there, in my opinion. He got up and he stumbled. He couldn't even walk back to the huddle.
And Emmanuel, what was going through your mind? I mean, you played an aggressive brand of football, so I know you like hard hitting in football, but what was going through your mind when you saw what happened with Tua?
Anger.
It's that simple, anger. And we need to be better about erring on the side of caution as opposed to erring on the side of risk.
And Matt, if you would pick up on that point, who is responsible for the player's safety, you think, and who needs to be the last line of defense?
Well, we're putting our trust in these protocols, and we've worked very hard. The NFLPA, the union, and the NFL, we've worked very hard at these protocols with doctors. I would just say, looking back, I think a learning lesson from this is we need to respect what we see on the field more. Like, I'm a high school football coach right now. If I saw that happen to one of my players, he is not going back into the game.
Manuel, what do you say to those trying to reconcile their love for the game with their worry for the safety of the players they love to watch?
The NFL has gotten much better about player safety. The NFL has made progress. Do not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Gentlemen, I'd like to ask you both this. I followed your careers on the field and now in the broadcast booth, and you are two of the more sober voices in sports, it seems to me. But I was struck by how passionate you both were in response to this story. Why?
I remember when I first started out my career, literally, you got a brain injury, and that's what it is. It's a brain injury. A coach would say to you, hey, you good? And the only answer you could really say is, yeah, I'm good. And you were back in the game. That's how it was not that long ago. And so we've worked so hard to change the culture, to help teammates whistle blow on their buddies, and to have coaches educated, like, hey, we need to coach different techniques.
Manuel, how about you?
You can get a new arm, you can get a new leg, to some degree you can get a new heart. You only have one brain. I know what injuries like that can do. And this is not anything that we should play with. This is nothing that we should scoff at. We have to all be righteously frustrated in order to make change.
And gentlemen, I'll get you out of here on this question. For me, this is a context question. Football was good to both of you. Both of you are good for football. Knowing what you know now, would you play football again if you were 20 years younger?
I absolutely would. And I would just say this, because I have a son who's playing. He's a junior in high school, and he's playing football. And my wife and I have talked about it. The game is so much safer than it's ever been.
Would I play it again? Yes, but I would play it the same way I played it now. Play my 4 years professionally, get vested, get pension, and then get out of there.
Gentlemen, so grateful for the honest conversation. Appreciate you. Continued success to both of you, and we'll see you down the road.
Thank you.
Coming up, diversity controversy. Why the Minneapolis school system has turned into a political battlefield.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Minneapolis, a city that's been beleaguered by racial unrest over the last few years, finding itself in the spotlight yet again, this time for a controversial school district policy. The teachers union voted to prioritize teachers from underrepresented groups to help address historical wrongs. But not everyone is pleased with the policy. Here's ABC's Ike Ajachi.
The Tennessee school board under fire for removing a Holocaust novel from its curriculum.
A North Carolina school district is beefing up security.
Teachers in Seattle with an important decision to make, return to the classroom or head to the picket lines.
Coast to coast, teachers are facing unprecedented challenges, from debates about critical race theory and banned books to budget cuts and increased worries about school safety.
All of the drama that has been surrounding education lately makes a lot of teachers feel like they're walking on eggshells.
Here in Minneapolis, teacher Tiffany Dougherty is also feeling the stress.
One thing that's changed my school is that they cut math. So I am now the only full-time eighth grade math teacher.
But there's also an added layer of scrutiny for the school district where Tiffany works, a new policy that's drawn the ire of conservative camps and media outlets, putting her and her fellow Minneapolis educators at the center of a political battle.
In the event of layoffs, white teachers have to be fired first, regardless of seniority or performance.
It's kind of like racism, right?
The union movement and too much of the left that used to, in my view, support laws that prohibited racial discrimination are now embracing the exact opposite.
As part of a new contract, the Minneapolis Public School District, or MPS, plans to prioritize educators from underrepresented groups in an attempt to remedy the continuing effects of past discrimination.
If you go back to Brown versus Board, who were the first teachers to be let go when we, you know, integrated schools? Black teachers. And so, you know, this is like a long history that it goes way beyond just our district.
Tiffany, or Miss Dougherty, as her students call her, fought for that new policy. She's invested more than 10 years of her career teaching for Minneapolis public schools, of which she's a graduate.
I told my students a few years ago, being a teacher in Minneapolis is living my dream.
She gets to live her dream right here at Ann Wotton Middle School. What do you love most about being an educator?
Kids. That moment when, you know, that you've reached them, especially in math.
Tiffany has made her mark at her school, but is still considered a rarity. Why do you call yourself a unicorn?
Because I'm a woman, I'm black, I speak Spanish, and I teach math. So I think I'm pretty unique.
Tiffany has a diverse background, just like the student body at MPS, where roughly two-thirds of the students are children of color. But the majority of teachers in the district are white, similar to the population of Minneapolis.
I believe I'm the only black person or person of color on our team.
What are some other unique challenges that you face as being one of the only black teachers in your school?
I end up representing everyone. Sometimes you feel like people are leaning on you as the resource for students of color.
The strain of the pandemic led MPS teachers to stage a strike earlier this year. For 3 weeks in March, the teachers union fought for a number of reforms. Greta Callahan, a former kindergarten teacher, is the president of the union that represents MPS teachers. She says retaining educators of color was just one item on a laundry list of demands.
We don't have full-time nurses in all of our buildings. We don't have the social workers and counselors that our students deserve. We have way too many kids in our classrooms, and the turnover of staff is so high.
To end the strike, the school district and the teachers union agreed to a new contract that addressed several needs, such as a living wage for educational support professionals, a cap on class sizes for each grade, and more mental health support for students. The contract also granted staff a one-time $4,000 bonus. Most notably, the district agreed to boost efforts to retain and recruit minority teachers.
In the last 2 years, we've had a couple hundred teachers of color leave our district by choice.
One of the aspects of that contract that's getting a lot of attention right now are the layoffs. Can you describe that policy?
If there are layoffs, the least senior person, if that person is from an underrepresented group, that person would maintain their position, and we would essentially go to like the next person in that seniority list to lay off.
Underrepresented. That is a particularly broad term. Can you give us some examples of individuals who would be considered in that category?
Yes. It could be someone who is on the autism spectrum and teaches autistic students, someone from the LGBTQIA+ community.
So the term underrepresented can also be applied to white people based on the categorizations that you just laid out, correct?
Technically, yes.
A majority of teachers and staff who are mostly white approve the policy, which is notable because historically, predominantly white unions have often resisted attempts to correcting racial imbalance. Already, the policy is being challenged in court by a conservative-leaning government watchdog group.
It was an in-your-face attack on the rule of law here, especially in the area of racial discrimination.
Judicial Watch filed a lawsuit on behalf of a Minnesota taxpayer claiming the contract requires administrators to make hiring and firing decisions based on race.
When it comes to layoffs or potential layoffs in this teacher's union contract, if you're black, your name is skipped and the next non-minority gets laid off. And while on the back end, if you get rehired and you're a non-minority, your name is skipped and the next black senior person gets hired. I don't understand why this is even a debate.
One of the key words used in the contract is the word underrepresented. The union president did say, though, that white educators could fall under this category under certain circumstances. Does that make a difference?
This section of the contract references teachers of color. So if they want to litigate what they mean by that, that's what the courts are for.
While the policy does not specifically mention the words race or ethnicity, Fitton argues the title of the heading, Protections for Educators of Color, makes it plain.
Now, I want you to do the mirror image of that. The contract says protecting white teachers, and then they have language that is seemingly neutral in how they're going to affect that. Do you think a court's going to say that's not race discrimination? I don't buy it.
I think it is very likely that a court will look both at the heading that specifically references teachers of color and the body of the document, which references members of underrepresented groups. They'll often look to kind of public comments made in the course of considering or adopting a policy. It's quite routine for courts to cast a pretty wide net in trying to get their arms around what a policy really means and how it is intended to operate.
This lawsuit has no teeth. Hundreds of teachers are leaving this profession, and we can't fill the positions we have. That's the real fight.
I think that the policy is clearly drafted to respond to one of the exceptions that the case law identifies, which is where a policy is race conscious, but is race conscious because of a history of discrimination perpetuated by the very institution creating the policy in question.
Arguably, the most important stakeholders in the conversation, though, are the students. Many of them are very aware of the challenges their teachers face and the impact it has on their education. In fact, some were so passionate, they joined the march with their teachers.
Teachers are fed up at this point. They're like really getting strict and harsh, but a lot of them are just, you know, tired.
These are Tiffany's former middle school students, now high school seniors. They stayed close with Tiffany long after leaving her classroom because of the impact they say she had on them.
She gave me like a good real world perspective. Her being like a black teacher, it's nice being able to relate to her like as a minority.
Research suggests that having diverse educators in schools is beneficial for all students. The Center for Education Data and Research found that having a teacher of the same race or ethnicity may increase test scores and reduce the likelihood of disciplinary issues.
I think like teachers like Ms. Doherty are like, they're that much more important because if you have a teacher who like makes it a place you want to be, I think that helps a lot.
I was automatically excited to have her because she was a black teacher, you know, I can relate to her. Other teachers, it's more of, they go home, you know, and we never speak again after that year, but with Ms. Doherty, it's longer than just a school year, it's forever with her.
So, about those students, what is it about them that inspires you to stick with this profession?
I look out at them, and I literally see the future. I feel the weight of the responsibility of my job.
Hi, guys.
I know that if I don't do my very best, then I'm failing all of us.
Oh, hi, my baby.
Our thanks to Ike. Be right back. And finally, we end this evening with a programming note. My co-anchor Juju Chang has an exclusive interview with actress Constance Wu airing here on Nightline tomorrow evening. You won't want to miss it. And that's Nightline for this evening. Catch our full episodes on Hulu. We'll see you right back here same time tomorrow. Thanks for the company, America. Good night.